And Noah builded an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease.
Okay.
Is that a chunk or more?
Well, now let's read all of it. Chapter 9.
Okay. Does someone else want to read?
Do it. And God pronounced a blessing upon Noah and his sons and said to them, Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread and terror of you shall be upon every beast of the land, every bird of the air, all that creeps upon the ground, and upon all the fish of the sea. They are delivered into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave the green vegetables and plants, I gave you everything. But you shall not eat flesh but the life of it, which is its blood. And surely for you will require it, and from every man who spills another's lifeblood, I will require his blood. By man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And you, be fruitful and multiply, fruitful abundantly upon the earth, and multiply on it. Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, Behold, I establish my covenant or pledge with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, whether the birds, the livestock, or the wild beasts of the earth. Along with you, as many as came out of the ark, every animal of the earth. I will establish my covenant or pledge with you. Never shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Neither shall there ever again be a flood to destroy the earth and make it corrupt. And God said, This is the token of the covenant, solemn pledge, which I am making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I sent my bow, rainbow, in a cloud, and it shall be a token or sign of a covenant or solemn pledge between me and the earth. And it shall be that when I bring clouds over the earth, and the bow, rainbow, is seen in the clouds, I will earnestly remember the covenant or a solemn pledge, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters will no longer become a flood to destroy and make all flesh corrupt. When the bow...
Is that verse 17 or...?
17, it's not 16.
Oh, okay.
When the bow is in the clouds and I look upon it, I will remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. In verse 17, God said to Noah, This rainbow is the token or sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh of the earth.
Okay, thank you.
What translation?
This is the...
When you read token or sign, is that both in the text or?
Yeah, they're both in the text. It's an amplified Bible.
Okay, and let's read from Isaiah here, Isaiah 42, starting in verse 7. And let's just read to verse 21. Someone wants to, so from 7 to 21.
Isaiah 42?
Yep. Okay. You will open the eyes of the blind and set free those who sit in your presence. I alone am the Lord your God. No other God may share my glory. I will not let idols share my praise. The things I predicted have now come true. Now I will tell you of new things even before they begin to happen. Sing a new song to the Lord. Sing his praise all the world. Praise him, you that sail the sea. Praise him, all creatures of the sea. Sing distant lands and all who live there. Let the desert and its towns praise God. Let the people of Kedar praise him. Let those who live in the city of Sela shout for joy from the tops of the mountains. Let those who live in distant lands give praise and glory to the Lord. The Lord goes out to fight like a warrior. He is ready and eager for battle. He gives the war cry of battle shout. He shows his power against his enemies. God says, for a long time I kept silent. I did not answer my people. But now the time to act has come. I cry out like a woman in labor. I will destroy the hills and mountains and dry out the grass and trees. I will turn the river valleys into deserts and dry out the pools of water. I will lead my blind people by roads they have never traveled. I will turn their darkness into light and make rough country smooth before them. These are my promises, and I will keep them without fail. All who trust in idols, who call images their gods, will be humiliated and disgraced. The Lord says, listen, you deaf people, look closely, you that are blind. Is anyone more blind than my servant, Moses, or the messenger I send? Israel, you have seen so much, but what has it meant to you? You have ears to hear with, but what have you heard? The Lord is a God who is eager to save, so he exalted his laws and teachings, and he wanted his people to honor him. But now his people have been plundered.
Oh, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you. All right.
To verse 15?
21.
Yeah, 15 up there.
Oh, sorry.
You're right. So, according to the readings, there's, I guess, a verse 21, but...
So we can read through...
I just read it all to keep the context together.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Right, so the last verse there is, the Lord wanted to exhibit his justice by magnifying his law and displaying it. Okay, and then Micah 7:9, I'll just read, I must endure the Lord's anger, for I have sinned against him. But then he will defend my cause and accomplish justice or righteousness on my behalf. He will lead me out into the light. I will experience firsthand his deliverance. Or righteousness or justice. So, all right, so let's keep all this in mind. So, for this, how many people have been here? Is this your first time here to this Bible study? So, a few people. So, I'll just give a little introduction to what we're doing. Every week in the synagogue, Jews read from the first five books of Moses, the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy. They read a section over the year, and that's called the Parashah. And then on top of that, there's a Haftarah, which is readings from the prophets, which is also added on to those readings from Moses. And that's done every year. It's like an annual cycle, right? You probably knew that. But in the time of Jesus, most scholars understand that it wasn't a yearly cycle. It was done every 3 years. And they've found some fragments, manuscripts in Genizot, which are, what do you call those in English?
Storage houses for old texts.
Yeah. Where
you can't throw away a holy text, and so you put them permanently.
So when if you walk around Jerusalem, you'll see these like bins. They look like maybe trash bins, but they have special doors on them, and you put holy books in there. The ones that have kind of fallen apart, you've lost some pages, and so you can never really get rid of them technically. And so, anyways, in Cairo, I think it was in the last century, they found one of these type of Genizas, and in it they found manuscripts that go back, maybe not the manuscripts themselves, the actual ones, but the texts that go back before the time of Jesus. It was quite a treasure trove. And in it, they were able to piece together, they have a rough idea of what they were reading at the time of Jesus, as far as the parasha.
The section.
Yeah. So anyways, that's why these verses are stuck together here. Anyways. And so...
All three.
This is their best their best guess of what they found. Yeah. So this morning, all we're going to do is we've already read everything, and now let's talk about what we've read. Let's go back to Genesis 8, and this will be a discussion, basically, of what do we see here, what things pop out. And the more eyes and more opinions, the better, because that's what makes a community. So let's start off with the very first verse in Genesis 8. Everybody knows this is the story of the flood, and we all have our preconceived ideas for those who have grown up in the church, or even in Western culture, the flood is a big biblical theme that people know about. So God says to Noah, verse 16, what's he say? Come out from the ark. In Hebrew, what's the word?
Tseh.
Which is
over our door here, Yetziah. Yetziah is the Yud Tzadik Aleph Yetzah is the root, is someone who's exited the room. This is the exit, you go out that way. So come out of the ark. And not just Noah, but everyone, right? His wife, his sons, their wives, all the animals. Verse 17, and it gives through this whole list of things like that. And I found this interesting, Yetzah, because what do you have in verse 17? Kol alemes havomes al haaretz hotze, is how they've, or hayetze, is how they've understood it, itach. So again, not only do you go out, but take out. So you have this this hifu. Hotzi is how you would say it, the command form. Bring out all these animals, again from the same root. Let's just point out all of those. Do you see anywhere else there as we're reading along where verse 18, what's it say? Vayetzeh. So they went out, Noah and his wife and everyone.
And then later, him yetzu.
Yeah, verse 19, and they went out. And the reason why... why this popped out to me is when we were, if you look back in Isaiah 42, verse 7, the very first verse, what's it say in Isaiah 42, verse 7?
They don't see.
Right, the whole verse is...
לפקוח עיניים עברות להוציא ממסגר אסיר מבית כלא יושבי חושך.
Right.
Open the eyes of the blind to bring out from bondage the prisoner, and from the jail those who sit in darkness.
So there, in the ancient Near East, what is a prison? What is a place like a jail? Where do they hold prisoners? even in the time of Jesus, think about the prophet Jeremiah when he was held prisoner. Where was he held? In a cistern. It's basically a hole. That's the prison. There is no light in there. And the longer you're held in there, the more you become blind. And maybe not, you don't lose your sight, but your eyes lose the ability. Like when they do come out, they can't, they're so blinded by the light, it takes a long, long time for someone's eyes to adjust, depending on how long you've been in the darkness. And so it's interesting, how can we see maybe this parallel here with Genesis?
The ark was dark.
Okay, so what's the ark consist of? What's it made of? What, or what's the shape of it? What's the...
It's a big box.
It's a big box. Okay, first off, the ark's... That's right. Okay, wait. We'll come to your... That's, you have the important one. First off, the ark is not a boat, right? Everyone knows that. It's a box. It's called a teva.
It's really like that box on the
center.
Like that box. The one
on
the
building.
So, which one?
On what building?
Anyway, doesn't matter.
Another building.
Oh, are building? Oh, on Hebron Road?
No, no, no.
I mean
the one downtown. But anyway, sorry.
Oh, no, no. It's fine. We can tell us later.
Just teva means a box.
Teva is basically a box. And it only appears twice in the Bible, this word, the story of Moses, and what's the other story? The what?
Moses.
Yeah. So Moses, how do we usually say, well, baby Moses, what's he put into?
Basket.
A basket is what we usually somehow say in English, but it's actually teva, and so... Again, it's this idea of a box. It's something that just kind of can float.
Today, you can get a post office box. Tevat doa, it's the same word.
Right. So, okay, now, coming back to your comment about it had one window, right?
Yeah.
That's, where is that found?
I don't know
where it's at. Yeah, Genesis 8.
In the last section that we read last week, it says that
verse
Noah
six.
Opened the window which he had made.
Right. Genesis 8:6.
To send out the dove, so.
I mean, it seems that there's only one window.
Yeah, I mean.
According to Genesis 8:6, he...
We know there's a door because God shut them in.
Right.
But that couldn't be opened until you're actually getting out. So
anyway, let's just throw out, theoretically, the ark is a very dark place. It's got one window, and the door's never opened until the very end. And
how long were they in there?
A year.
Something like, yeah.
Well, yeah.
All the circulation, air, and breathing, and...
They had a bed right on the top.
Well,
I don't know.
You know, again, it's not the Bible's not it's not a scientific manual to explain. I know it does, like for the tabernacle, it goes into measurements and the temple and Ezekiel, and it does go into specific things like that, but it doesn't always give you every fine detail. And so maybe there are warmer windows, maybe not. But we just know of one window.
Well, the other thing is...
And it had a circulation vent, right?
It's pitched to help be watertight,
right?
And pitch is black, right?
Right.
So presumably, all the walls are black. So not only is there no light, but there's black walls. I mean, that you'd feel like you were definitely in a cave darkness.
Right.
I mean, if you've seen the movie, they light little fires in there. Has anyone here seen the movie Noah?
Yeah.
So, what?
We're talking about the ark being dark.
Uh-huh. And it runs.
Because there's only one window is mentioned, and it's got pitch all over it, and
So the point is let's imagine the ark is dark and like a cave, which in that sense, it's a prison. Because the caves or the cisterns, the holes, or the prisons. And even this whole idea of the prison being dark goes on into the Western civilization. You know, they build castles and you throw someone down in the bottom of the castle. Same concept. You're not thinking about prisoner rights and they need fresh air and water and all that. So when you come to Isaiah 42, you know, and it says the blind will see. They will be brought out of these prisons. It's that kind of, it's interesting. So let's just keep it at that for now. And because in a sense it's weird because the ark is not a prison, right? It's a lifeboat. We'll skip the boat part, but it's a lifesaver. It's something that's blessing the world. But we'll come back to that.
I just noticed it's got pitch on the inside and the outside. So really, when we draw the ark, it should be a big black box, right? Pitch is black.
But do you have to pitch the entire thing or just the cracks?
I don't know. It's
all right, so it's a question. So back to Genesis. So I brought up the word yetzah, going out, exiting. The next thing I noticed was in verse 20, Genesis 8, verse 20. Vayiven Noach Mizbeach. And Noah built an altar to the Lord. This is the first time in the Bible that we have an altar being built. In the story of Cain and Abel, it's kind of inferred, right, that they're bringing sacrifices to God. But it never goes through the whole sacrificial
system,
the development, the parts of it leading up to it. So he builds an altar, and what's he sacrifice on the altar?
The clean animals.
Okay. Right.
The ceremonially clean animals. So which there were seven each in the ark.
Which is very important, because if there'd only been two, then there'd be no more sheep, no more goats, no more cows.
So that's three pairs plus one.
Right.
I guess the one was for the sacrifice, maybe, and then the three pairs had a head start on reproducing.
Yeah.
It doesn't say how many he sacrificed, right? It just said he sacrificed.
Right. But they're the pure ones.
So maybe that one extra in each of the.
Right.
The clean animals.
And then what does God do with the sacrifice? He smells them. Yeah. What's so far we've read Genesis 1 to 8. What does this image of God smelling, the smell, what's it remind us of from what we've read so far in Genesis? We'll get to the blood part. That's still coming up.
Small, you mean like kind of like a
consuming?
Well, it's
smelling.
It's pleasant.
It's right.
Think about the Garden of Eden.
Yeah. He's enjoying it, and I'm thinking of the creation story in Genesis 2, the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
It says that God makes a man. God builds a woman.
And he breathes into them.
God breathed. Sorry?
Oh, sorry, it's plagues.
Yeah, but he's very physically involved is what I'm saying. It's like he's a human almost. He's there. He's.
And how he's described.
Yeah, how he's described. So it's interesting. It's very similar to Genesis chapter 2. And then he makes the proclamation he's no longer going to curse the earth because of man. So it's quite interesting.
And we all get to eat meat.
Right. So originally in Genesis chapter 1, what was men, what were humans supposed to eat according to the creation?
Grain.
Fruits and grain.
Fruits and grain.
The seed bearing grass. The animals got the vegetables.
Did anyone eat meat in the creation? No. No one ate meat according to Genesis chapter 1. But here, let's see, what is it? Verse chapter 9, verse 3 of Genesis. Man will now not only get to eat meat, he gets to have solid too, right? Yannick, Esav.
Yeah.
Because even before, who got to eat the vegetables according to Genesis chapter 1? The animals, right. They got to eat. They were vegetarian. And that reminds you of Isaiah chapter 7?
11. Well, there's several
7
places,
and 11, right?
Right?
Where it talks about the lion will eat grass or the ox and they'll all be buddies. So it's kind of that full circle idea of Eden, the original creation. But here, so why does man get to eat meat now? What? It's kind of strange. Is it because he's just done a sacrifice and so?
Well, it's before he did the sacrifice.
No, chapter 9 is after the sacrifice.
No, but here,
chapter 8:20 is the sacrifice.
Okay.
It's an olah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole burnt offering. It's not one you can eat because it all has to go be burnt up to God. But still, why would people get to eat meat now? It's interesting, huh?
I think there is a connection between Genesis 8 and 21. Satisfaction, shows his satisfaction. And in Genesis 1, verse 31, it was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Very good smell of satisfaction. God's feeling.
So what do you think he's satisfied with?
With the sacrifices.
With the sacrifice.
I don't know, what does it say about the first shedding of the blood of animals? I always wondered about that. When they Adam and Eve left the garden and gave them garments.
Yeah.
So who was it that shed the first blood actually?
It says God did, right? Because he gave it, but it doesn't mention what he did with the meat.
It doesn't say, it's just, but somehow we have to get those letters.
Yeah. Right.
So it's always,
it's a mystery.
I don't know if it has something to do with redemption, like God shed the first blood in creation, and then God, through Christ, shed the blood. I don't know if that's a really huge
rich,
but
I'm wondering
about
that.
I've heard that interpretation of that. There was a shedding of blood, like a silent or a precursor of sacrifice or something.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about this section right here is people can eat meat, so that means you're going to have to shed blood of the animal to eat it, right?
Yeah.
But then it says, don't eat the blood. That's in 9 verse 5. And then the next verse is saying, don't shed the blood of a human. So you've got three things involving blood here. One, you can kill an animal, but you don't eat the blood. But then you don't shed the blood of a human, which...
Or if you do, you'll be judged for it.
Right.
You'll be asked why, basically.
But again, it's weird. Why wasn't this said right after the story of Cain and Abel?
Uh-huh.
You know? Because he shed his brother's blood. It's interesting how this whole blood section comes together right here. And they're all related because of blood, but it's kind of strange because, you know, how does shedding the blood of a human and shedding the blood of an animal related? Because they're different.
I guess it wasn't the life and the blood.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's somehow, they're connected because blood. Life is edible?
Valuable.
Valuable.
And yet further on in the history, they shed the blood of already. Possessing the land.
Right.
Wipe out everything.
Right, right. And then it's all about context, maybe, because here they've just come off the ark and everybody's related to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure. Right.
But it is, it's interesting. Like, if you look, if you read Genesis 9, verse 1 to 9, verse 7, in a sense, we have a new creation story. Because it starts off and it says,
fruitful and multiply.
The Lord blessed Noah. And then he said, be fruitful and multiply. Mm-hmm. Remember in Genesis chapter 1, it's the same thing. And the Lord blessed them and he said, be fruitful and multiply, right?
And it's interesting, in chapter 1, he keeps telling man, you know, you're supposed to rule over all the animals.
Right.
Here.
Verse 2.
In verse 2, yeah, he says, now they're going to be afraid of you and I'm giving them into your hand.
Yeah.
So, what does, in a sense, it's reaffirming their rule over them.
But it sounds ominous.
But now it's showing that the other side is because you rule and because you are going to be chasing them down to eat them, you know, like now they're going to be afraid of you. Whereas before, presumably they weren't.
Right.
In Garden of Eden or wherever.
And then here it's talking about what you can and what you can eat, which Genesis 1 talks about what they would eat.
What you can't eat.
Is there anything that having to do with genetics? You know, there were things happening before with genetics, and the people had become very wicked. So the destruction of the gene, of a certain gene pool of some sort. I'm just...
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, possibly, it doesn't say, but...
I mean, clearly, they, at the time of writing, don't have a concept of genetics in the same way that we do. They understand traits passing down family lines, but they don't talk about genes. They're not discovered, so, you know, so you can interpret it, yeah? Brainstorming.
And in verse 6 it says, you know, you don't shed your brother's blood or the person's blood because they're created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. And again, that's chapter 1, the creation, right? He made female and male in image of God. So in a sense, and then it ends again with be fruitful and multiply, verse 7. So it's like we have this little short.
So it seems like there's a contrast then, like it's okay to kill the animals because they're not in the image of God. But it's not okay to kill a person because they are in the image of God.
Yeah.
And so even the animals aren't supposed to kill the people. So they're like, they're a special status above everything else.
So I want to call this a new creation. In a sense, Noah's the new Adam. Mm-hmm. We're all descended from Noah because everyone else is dead. And
so what you're saying ties into a couple Bible studies ago, you were talking about... Cain's descendants, like all the bad guys, the Tubal Cain,
were killed.
Right. And if you're going to talk about, you know, wiping out the evil gene pool, basically all Cain's descendants are not Noah and his sons. They're like the contrasting genetic line. And so they would be the ones killed in the flood.
Wiped out, yeah. So now I want to ask the question... Isaiah 42, verse 21, and Micah 7, 9. What do y'all see a connection there? You probably have to see it in the Hebrew, maybe, depending on your translations. But Isaiah 42, verse 21. In Micah 7, 9.
Mm-hmm. That's a bit. You mean before that, verse 20.
21 in the
Hebrew.
No. Are you looking at Adonai chafetz lema'an
ra'ita rabot velo tishmo pakoach oznaim velo ishma? That one?
No, that's not 20. Are you 43?
Okay, wait. Oh, but that's 21.
Chapter 42.
It's chapter 42.
Verse 21.
I have Adonai chafetz. Oh, that's what I first read.
Yeah.
Adonai chafetz, but what's...
Lema'an tzidko.
Yadir Torah.
Yadir. And in Micah 7:9, Za'af Adonai esa ki chatati lo ad asher yariv rivi v'asa mishpati yotzeini la'or ere betzidkato.
Okay, so the tzidka, the justice is
connected. So there's this word, tzedek.
Tzedek.
Tzedek. Utzadak. Utzadik. You have all these different words that come out of there. And this is often translated like to be righteous. Tzedaka. Is righteousness. Sometimes it can be translated as justice.
Is it the same word? Because I don't know if it's the same word for when you give alms.
Yeah.
Staka.
Yeah. In the time of Jesus, it takes on.
Your righteousness is how you care for the poor or how you care for others.
What you do with your money, practically. So,
and it's true, like if you look at Jewish picture books of the flood, you'll see like when it says Noah was a righteous man, you'll see him giving alms. Giving,
really?
Yeah, some of the books and cartoons.
And that's what Cornelius did in Acts. God saw his giving alms, his charity.
Yeah, it mentions charity and praying.
Yeah. So... this is the connection I see here. And again, you get this idea of the darkness, right? Being brought out, Micah 7:9, being brought to the light, right? And when you're brought to the light, what do you see? The Lord's staka, you know, his righteousness. And so going back to the story of Noah. What is Noah known as from the very beginning of his life? He's righteous, right? Somebody want to read that? Genesis, let's see. Genesis 6, verse 9.
This is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time. And he walked with God.
Genesis.
Sadiq Tamim.
Ish Sadiq, yeah. Can someone read Genesis 7:1?
The Lord then said to Noah, go into the ark, you and your whole family, because I have found you righteous in this generation.
How about Ezekiel 14:14?
Those three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it. They should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God.
In verse 20.
Though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, says the Lord God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter. They shall but deliver their own souls by their righteousness.
And then if we go to the New Testament, like Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7.
Prompted by faith, Noah being forewarned by God concerning the task which was yet, not as yet there was no visible sign, took heed in diligent favor of the foot construction, preparing not the deliverance of his own family. By this, his faith which relied on God, he passed judgment and sentence on the world's unbelief, heir and possession of righteousness, that relationship of the right into which God puts the person who has faith.
Okay, yeah. Righteousness. And then 2 Peter Chapter 2, verse 5.
And if he did not spare the ancient world, but did protect Noah, herald of righteousness, along with seven others, and God brought flood on an ungodly world. And if he turned to ashes the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he condemned them to destruction, having anointed them to serve as an example to future generations of the ungodly.
Okay, so specifically about Noah there, again, he's a herald of righteousness or a preacher of righteousness. And that's a key characteristic of him.
He didn't have any daughters.
He didn't have any daughters.
Daughters in law.
He preached 120 daughters.
Yes. First, and so what does it say here in the Peter? In 2 Peter 2, 5. It says that he was a herald of righteousness, and what do your translations have after that?
Seven other people.
Okay, in the Greek it doesn't say that, but the translation's not wrong. Does anybody else have another translation there?
Herald of righteousness along with seven others.
Okay. But,
and that'd be seven others historically, not...
Well,
it's referring to the three sons and their wives and his wife, because it keeps mentioning that in our story in Genesis.
Right. No one else has another translation there. Second, nothing different. No. The seven others part. No one else has another. Okay, so in the Greek it says Noah the eighth, the number eight, the eighth, Noah the eighth. So the translators have just tried to
explain,
make it float.
What eight,
yeah,
means.
What does that mean that he's the eighth? Which it means there were seven others, right?
Why wouldn't he be the first and then the others, you know? So it's...
Well, this...
Right, the clean animals... There are
seven others of his kind.
Uh-huh. That's true.
And the seven of his kind.
That's another way to see the eight.
And
that. That what?
You have seven clean animals.
Yeah.
And so there's Noah and then seven others of his kind.
Because he's
being
clean,
like
too.
Clean, yeah.
Okay.
The tamim.
But not historical.
Why not?
No. Yeah, well.
What is the meaning of eight?
We counted, was it 10? I think he's the 10th generation.
Yeah, he's the 10th generation.
Well, so, the concept of testing is connected to 10, trials and testing. So in that sense, he is a righteous man that should endure a big trial.
So let's do this. But, let's go to 1 Peter 3. We'll stay in Peter, but go to 1 Peter chapter 3. See if we can... talk about this eight thing.
Isn't there a psalm we should be reading on the eighth?
I guess I think I'm off here. Okay, first, did I say 1 Peter 3?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so verse 20. He's talking about, Peter here's talking about kind of like the end, and after they were disobedient long ago, when God patiently waited in the days of Noah as an ark was being constructed, in the ark a few, that is eight souls, were delivered through water. Okay, so there again we have eight, and we all know what the eight are, right? The wife, the three sons, and it's assumed the three wives. Again, though, in the text, it doesn't say like how, I don't know, just throw out the idea. Polygamy was a part of the world. So how do we know there wasn't more wives, for instance, than three? And according to this, there was one wife each. But anyways, it's just.
Well, that was part of them being righteous.
Well, no, that's Noah. His sons might not be.
You're like, right. Like, you're right. But they were still young enough, maybe, that
right.
They hadn't gotten around to getting more wives.
Okay, so in the ark, a few, that is eight souls, were delivered through water.
Mm-hmm.
And this prefigured baptism. So it's interesting here. They've taken a terrible thing, water, which is actually a judgment on the world to destroy, is now seen as something that saves you. The actual water is no longer about water of destruction, but it is a water of what?
Recreation.
Of recreation, of cleaning yourself. It's like a big bath, right? Because it says in verse 21, the washing, not the washing off of physical dirt, but the pledge of a good conscience to God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Okay, so recreation. So this brings me back to this whole thing. What is the number eight? What can it mean in the Bible?
Because everybody knows you have a week, right? One. Yom Rishon is Sunday. Yom Shani is Monday. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 is what?
Shabbat.
That's today.
That's today.
So number eight starts here, if you have a calendar. And so again, it is the first day of the week. And we just said, it's
the Lord's Day.
Yeah. It's a new beginning, right? Because we already pointed out, this is told as a new creation, that Moses is this new, like this new Adam. So number eight begins kind of like the new day of a new week, of a new creation.
Mm-hmm.
Who else came out of a dark, dark cave on the first day of a new week?
Jesus.
And you see that here in Peter, where he's saying, and this prefigured baptism, which now saves you, not the washing off of physical dirt, but the pledge of a good conscience to God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So,
resurrection.
That's right. First day.
But the first day
of a new week.
The same. The first day after Shabbat is the Sunday. It's a metaphorical eighth day. You're right. Because the week is a cycle. It goes always back 1 to 7. So there is no number eight. But if there were number eight, it would be the first day again. So it's like the new.
And this also seems to add credence to why Noah's called the eighth. You know, like. Why not the first?
Right.
Okay.
Circumcision is also in there.
The eighth day.
That's interesting. Circumcision, yeah. And that's a covenant.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that also goes to what is going to be the covenant that God makes with Noah and the earth?
The rainbow.
Rainbow. Colors.
Right. So you've got this rainbow, which in Hebrew is keshet, and which
the bow.
It means basically it's like a bow and arrow. That's its essential meaning. And it says it's going to be a sign.
So God's hanging up his bow, he's not gonna use it against you anymore.
It's going to be an oath. And it says, again, you have brit, which is your, so this is your covenant, and this is your sign. And the sign of the covenant will be the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of, Katarina's kind of goes with what you just said. There's only one other place where this comes together, where it says the sign will.
In Isaiah 42, you remember?
No, where the sign, where is it? It's in Genesis chapter 17, verse 11. If you want to look at that. Genesis chapter 17. Verse 11. Someone want to read that?
And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of a covenant between me and you.
Yeah, so here in Hebrew, it doesn't come out as much in the way it's translated here, but V'haya le'ot brit, b'ni u'b'nechem. And if you go back to Genesis 9, it says, where's the verse? It's like 9,
it's down there.
10, 9, 11. It's Zot Ot HaBrit. You just find it. Here it is. Genesis 9, verse 12. Vayome Elohim Zot Ot HaBrit Asher Ani Noten B'ni U'B'nechem U'Bein Kol Nefesh Haya Asher Itchem L'Dorot Olam. So that could be a nice connection to circumcision being on the eighth day as well. Or that idea of the sign of this covenant only appears here and it appears there. Noah and Abraham.
And there's some parallels also between circumcision and baptism where you're joining a community of faith.
That's right.
It's a covenant.
Paul talks about that, I think, quite a bit. That's a good point.
But then also Isaiah 42 has the Brit.
Right, so let's go back to Isaiah 42 and then we'll finish there.
Verse 6.
Oh, in verse 6 before. Do you want to read the English?
I, the Lord, have called you in righteousness. So, betzedek, kraticha betzedek, we had the tzedek thing. And I will hold your hand and will keep you and give you for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles.
That's Isaiah 42, verse 6.
Uh-huh. So you have the covenant and you have the idea of with this covenant comes light. Mm-hmm. And so this whole thing of bringing out of the darkness, recreating, and now there's light, and it's to spread to all the people. And then right after that, to open up the eyes of the blind and to bring out from darkness.
One last thing. God destroys the earth by water, right? And then the whole point of the rainbow is that he will never do it again, right? Mm-hmm. But how does Peter interpret this? Second Peter. How does he understand, Second Peter chapter 3. What do we all know? We've always heard so many sermons on
fire,
right? Mm-hmm. Just real quick, Second Peter chapter 3. Second Peter chapter 3. Around verse 10. Sorry, verse 7. Well, starting verse 6. Through these things, the world existing at the time was destroyed when it was deluged with water. But by the same word, the present heavens and earth have been reserved for fire, by being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly.
And Nadine brought up last week about Revelation 22.
Fire coming down?
Fire coming down from the heavens and destroying the evil and Satan.
Yeah.
Evildoers and Satan.
And this is where I want to end here is, if you go back to, obviously Peter is after Isaiah, but it seems like maybe Peter might know a bit of a tradition that's coming from Isaiah 42. If you go back to Isaiah 42, where we're reading, Isaiah 42, go ahead.
Well, verse 25. He made his heel the first his anger and saw him driving into the war, that fire to his anger burned throughout Israel.
Okay. Could be. I mean, yeah, definitely there's the fire there. But here in just a few verses earlier in chapter 42, verse 9, it says, look, my earlier predictive oracles have come to pass. Now, and if we understand this in the whole case of Noah and the flood, you know,
flood
it says
there's
going to be a flood. There's going to be a flood. And it happened. It says, now I announce new events. Before they begin to occur, I reveal them to you. Okay, so what are those? And here you have, talking about all those who go down to the water, to the sea. Kind of makes me think of this idea of the flood waters rising here. And what I want to point out particularly, the Lord emerges like a hero, like a warrior. He inspires himself for battle. And so, remember, a rainbow actually is a bow. It's something that a warrior uses. So that also kind of gives a little hint, I feel. And then he says in verse 15, so what's the new things he's going to do? I will make the trees on the mountains. Sorry, it's not trees in the Hebrew, but that's how the translation has it. But I will make the mountains and the hills wither up. I will dry up all their vegetation. I will turn streams into islands. I will dry up pools of water. And how does that happen physically? How do you remove water? You have to have heat, evaporation, to wither something up. And so it seems like there's a hint to a destruction by fire here.
And also in chapter 24.
Of Isaiah?
It has that same, that the fury is going to eat it up. These are metaphors of fire. We read it last week and I couldn't find it, but it's chapter 24 something.
9.
It sounds right.
Also with the pleasant odor of the sacrifice, the burnt offering, there's a fire for the renewal.
Yeah.
Huh.
Or verse 6, actually.
Possibly.
It says, that's it. It says, Haru Yoshve Eretz. So they burned. The people of the land burned.
So to finish up, basically, there seems to definitely be, if you read into the text and under it, and you look for hints and things like this, it's very interesting what we find here, the connections of Isaiah 42 to Noah. And also, again, it seems like some of our writers in the New Testament, like Peter, possibly knew some of these older traditions. And there is there's a precedent for why fire is going to destroy the world next, not water. So something to think about. So
it's also interesting when you connect chapter 42 in Isaiah to the flood, you're redeemed for a reason. You're supposed to then spread God's righteousness. And here in 42, he's talking to the people of Israel as you're going to be a light for the nations. Like the people that are redeemed of God, it's not just a selfish thing like, oh, yay, I survived the flood. It's like, now it's your role to make sure that that righteousness goes out and like, you know, that you set in place good systems that will bring what creation was meant to be and not, you know, the evil that just had to get wiped out kind of thing.
Right.
You become a sign.
A what?
A sign.
Yeah, yourself, yeah.
And you're a new creation.
And you're a new creation. Mm-hmm.
Right. When we're all baptized, we're new creations.
You find many answers in the New Testament about the Old Testament. So what is the New Testament? Is the Old Testament revealing?
Right.
The Old Testament, the New Testament is the Old Testament revealing. And the Old Testament is confusion.
Yes.
You can understand it better from the New Testament.
Shabbat shalom.